members of the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights, members of this group special that made their own independent investigation since April of 2015 to the last year. And they also suggest that the members of the Argentine foresting team also should be part of this.
Annabel Hernandez, we have to leave it there. Mexican investigative journalist, we thank you for being with us from Mexico City. Her book, The True Night of Iguala. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Shea.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Join KBOO and Kofallin Cultural Center on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral historians before the screening of Keita, Heritage of the Griots, a film which blends modern events with magical realism, mythology, and history. Again, that's an evening of the culture of Mali, including the screening of the film Keita, Heritage of the Griots, on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial, community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani, boing, boing.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth exclusively on Pacifica Radio and its affiliate stations. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Rick Donald Ross, better known as Freeway Ricky Ross, and Cornell Coach Ward join us for a special in-studio discussion about their role in the explosion of crack cocaine that hit U.S. streets in the 1980s. The price they paid for their role in the saturation of crack cocaine in South Los Angeles and elsewhere, and their work now to inspire youth to avoid the path they took in their youth, as well as their gang prevention work. Freeway Ricky Ross is the subject of a film by award-winning filmmaker Mark Levin entitled Freeway, Crackin' the System, that chronicles early days of the crack epidemic and the role played by Nicaraguan drug traffickers in bringing the drug to the United States and the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, who turned a blind eye to the trade. The Reagan administration, hailed as a hero today as one of America's best presidents, but he used the profits from crack cocaine sales starting in South Los Angeles to fund an illegal war against the left-leaning Sandinistas in Nicaragua. President Reagan backed the opposition to the Sandinistas, who were called the Contras. Congress initially refused to fund the Contras because of their abysmal human rights record. The impact of the crack cocaine epidemic is still being felt in South Los Angeles and other communities across the United States. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Democrats fought to shape the political battlefield in primaries across eight states, none more important than California, where Republicans avoided an embarrassing setback in the race for governor. Democratic Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom easily advanced to the general election, with Republican business executive John Cox coming in second. Newsom laid out the tenor of the campaign he'll wage against Cox, tying the Republican to Donald Trump, who's unpopular with most California voters.
It looks like voters will have a real choice this November between a governor who's going to stand up to Donald Trump and a foot soldier in his war on California.
Cox's strong finish put to rest GOP fears that no Republican would qualify for the deeply Democratic state's top office this fall, and the party's other candidates would suffer from a resulting lack of voter interest on Election Day. Trump endorsed Cox in the final weeks of the campaign. Cox addressed his remarks last night to Newsom, and his support for California's sanctuary state status protecting undocumented immigrants.
You're the one that's protecting MS-13. You're the one that's making our communities less safe. And the first act I make is to get rid of this sanctuary state law.
In Los Angeles, a printing error kept 119,000 people off the voting rolls. Some voted by provisional ballot, but others may have been discouraged. Former Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, an unsuccessful candidate for governor, called on voter registration officials to allow people to vote through Friday. In New Mexico, Democratic Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham won her party's nomination in the race to succeed outgoing Republican Governor Susana Martinez. If Grisham wins, she'll be the state's second Latina governor. Also in New Mexico, former state Democratic Party Chair Deborah Holland, a tribal member of Laguna Pueblo, won her primary. She could become the first Native American woman in Congress if she wins this fall. The former president of USA Gymnastics refused to answer questions from a Senate subcommittee about how he handled allegations of sexual abuse by former team doctor Larry Nassar. Another former executive sat next to him and asserted that her former boss instructed her and others to keep quiet about athletes' claims. The USA Gymnastics president at the time, Steve Penny, repeatedly invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination before senators excused him from the hearing. Here's Democrat Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut.
I respect your right to invoke your Fifth Amendment privilege. You have that right, but you also have a responsibility. You were part of an organization that, in effect, prioritized medals and money over the young women and girls, some of them here today, who were sexually abused by Mr. Nassar.
The revelations about Nassar's conduct over two decades and the way it was handled by Penny and others have led Congress to call for drastic reforms of the U.S. Olympic Committee, USA Gymnastics, and other sports governing bodies. Argentina abruptly canceled a World Cup warm-up match after Israel's sports minister moved the game from Haifa to Jerusalem. The decision to withdraw from the sold-out match followed a vigorous Palestinian pressure campaign on Argentina. The Palestinian sports minister, Jabril Rajoub, welcomed the Argentine decision.
I appreciate their decision, and I think this is according to the FIFA statutes and according to their principles, their ethics, and their mission to promote ethics and values and to build a bridge between nations rather than to be a bridge or a tool for political ends as the Israelis tried.
Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman responded angrily, saying in a statement that it was, quote, unfortunate the Soccer Knights of Argentina did not withstand the pressure of the Israeli-hating insiders whose only goal is to harm our basic right to self-defense and bring about the destruction of Israel. Lieberman added, quote, we will not yield before a pack of anti-Semitic terrorist supporters. The Argentine move raised fears it could serve as a template for future boycotts of Jerusalem, most notably next year's scheduled hosting of the popular Eurovision Song Contest. Guatemalans living near the Volcano of Fire fled after officials ordered new evacuations for half a dozen communities. A column of smoke rose from the mountain and hot volcanic material began descending its south side. A national highway was closed. Rescuers, police, and journalists hurried to leave the area as a siren wailed and loudspeakers blared, evacuate. Sunday's unexpected blast left at least 75 people dead and 192 missing. I'm Eileen Alfandera. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And there's a film, Freeway, Crack in the System. And it tells the story of broken dreams, drug dealers, dirty cops, and government complicity. More compelling, reviewers say, than fiction. It's the real story behind the United States' longest war. This documentary by award-winning filmmaker Mark Levin exposes how the infiltration of crack cocaine destroyed inner-city neighborhoods across the United States. At the center of it all is the rise, fall, and the redemption of Freeway Ricky Ross, a street hustler who became the king of crack, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gary Webb, who broke the story of the CIA's complicity in the drug war. So I'd like to welcome in studio Freeway Ricky Ross. Freeway Ricky Ross, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Freeway Ricky Ross was the leader of South Central's first major crack distribution ring in the space of 4 years. Ricky Ross went from selling fractions of an ounce to shipping multi-million dollar cocaine shipments across the United States. Convicted of cocaine trafficking in 1996, Ricky Ross challenged his life sentence, something people thought would never happen, and ultimately served a total of 20 years in prison. Clearly, he is now out of prison, and he operates a t-shirt company and is a speaker and a teacher to at-risk youth in Los Angeles and across the country. So yet again, welcome.
Thanks again.
Alrighty. Also in studio with us is Ricky Ross's childhood buddy, Cornell Ward, also known as Coach, was a former collegiate football quarterback turned crack dealer, and was a member of the Freeway Boys crack dealing circle. He now coaches football and is the executive director of Unity One Foundation, which has been doing incredible work dedicated to gang intervention. So, Coach.
Again, thank you. Thank you
yeah,
for having me.
Everybody call you Coach, yes, or ma'am. Should I call you Cornell Ward?
Coach is as always welcome.
Coach is always welcome. Okay, what I'd like to do now actually is start with to give our listeners a sense of the film. Can we go to that clip right now?
Well, at one time I felt that selling cocaine was my purpose.
We were starving, just looking for a way to succeed.
The first time I seen rock cocaine was 1980.
Murder rate was sky high.
South of the 10 freeway was kind of a no man's land.
So, you know, we're selling it to the blacks. So you go into these neighborhoods, there's no cops, you can sell it where you want, and when they start killing each other, nobody cares.
I was going through like $1 million worth of drugs just about every day.
That's like gold. We can make a fortune.
He was maybe the biggest guy in LA.
Rick, Freeway Rick.
Freeway Rick was getting his dope from a very big operator. I think we're into something that's bigger than us, something we really can't deal with.
They had been trafficking on behalf of the United States government.
She could prove what she was saying.
The story was mind-boggling.
When I was young, let me tell you how it was where I come from.
As I've said before, no drug network will remain alive.
There's a lot of people who think that, you know, I made that whole thing up. What they don't realize is the CIA admitted.
See, I didn't know until I was sitting in prison how valuable an education was.
Yeah, drugs suck. Drugs are really bad. But the drug war is worse.
You want to know a version of hell, be the only guy playing straight in a dirty card game. And that's what the drug war is.
There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980.
Me being here is defying all odds. People don't get federal life sentences and beat them.
We've been spending billions and billions and billions of dollars every year on this war on drugs to find out that the government was involved. That's pretty astonishing.
Crack in the system.
Even if the government just turned a blind eye and didn't do anything about it, then you have to start questioning the whole system.
All right, there you go. And that was a clip from the film, Freeway, Crack in the System. Ricky, I'd like to start with you and talk about a bit about your early days, your childhood, and what was the situation of your mom and or immediate families. And Coach, I also want to get that similar story from you.
Well, my mom moved out here. I was about 3 years old when my mom moved out. We moved in with an uncle and aunt.
Moved from Texas?
From Texas, mm-hmm. Yeah, Tyler, Texas, to South Central Los Angeles. Eventually, my uncle came in drunk one night. He started stabbing his wife, and my mom stepped in. My mom carried a pistol at the time, and she killed her brother. And I was standing right on the side of her when it happened.
You saw the whole thing?
I saw the whole thing, yeah. I saw him stabbing her. Can still remember. I remember him laying on the floor, gasping for air. And I talk about it in the book. You know, I start the chapter off at that point in my life.
And the book is Freeway, Rick Ross, The Untold Autobiography, a Los Angeles Times best-selling book. And you also talk about it in the film as well.
So I do.
Do you remember that moment, or have you kind of blocked it out? Is it?
No, I remember totally. And it came back from time to time, you know, as you're growing up. You remember, because my uncle had also become my uncle, but he was also like a father to me. Just to be, you know, 3 years old and you're around that kind of drama is really dramatizing. My mom wound up going to jail for a while. I don't know how long. Me and my mom never really talked about it. The first time I asked her about it was when I started writing a book, and I asked her, could I put that in my book? So
you close to your mom?
Oh, very close, very close. I'm my mom's favorite, I think.
Oh, that's what all children say,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So it was dramatizing.
Yeah.
And that whole little ordeal, I believe, could have been what changed my life, because for some reason I didn't learn the fundamentals of my ABCs. And, you know, when you're 3, 4, 5 years old, is when you should be learning your fundamentals of ABCs.
Yeah.
And then it got to a point to where when I did know it, I started hiding it and ducking it.
Yeah.
So now I'm going through school not being able to read. And as you get older, it gets worse and worse and
right.
worse.
Right. So, Coach, what about your early days?
Well, my early days.
South L.A.?
South L.A., South Central.
You born there?
Born, raised in Watts, you know, Watts. Compton, right on the border there by the 105 freeway. And my circumstances is similar to his. My mom was a Rolling Stone. Wherever she laid her hat basically was our home.
Was she a single mom?
Yes. I never had an opportunity to meet my biological dad. I do know that the year before I was born in 63, it felt like I was in a lot of pain. My head was hurting. My body was aching. Not to know that when I was birthed, my dad was already beating my mom. So we have those same similarities, Rick and I, even though he's older. And, you know, I witnessed, you know, many men beating my mom, you know, as a child. And growing up in that dysfunctional household, you know, it's extremely tough on any child. I believe I grew into
dysfunctional this, community.
Low self-esteem. I mean, it was a lot of issues there.
Yeah.
And it was hard to break. I also know that my mom, I mean, similar stories. My mom, my sister's dad, got murdered by his girlfriend in our house. When we were going away from the house, he had snuck his girlfriend over, and he has a drinking problem. He beats on her. She pulls out a pistol and shoots him and kills him in our house.
Mm.
You know, so...
So you have that kind of similarity there. Now, Ricky, you talked about the neighborhood, and that's what I wanted to ask about, because I have been involved in a project that's also now a film called Tales of the Grim Sleeper. I've been dealing with the whole issue of black women who've been murdered since the mid-'80s on the streets of South L.A.
That was in our community.
Yeah.
Well, we're much aware.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I was all in the face of LAPD because they weren't doing, you know, anyway, that's a whole other story. But one of the things I was telling the filmmaker is just about the devastation that happened in South L.A. And South L.A. in so many ways is a community that survived, because there was a time where it was possible, like your mom, a lot of folks who left the South came to South L.A. You had a way of earning a living. That fled, and you had a community that was more or less devastated. You had the whole COINTELPRO operations, FBI operations against the militant black movements in, you know, that were part of South L.A. at the time. So then you had a situation where the businesses more or less had fled, auto industry or anything else. The militant black movements had pretty much been destroyed. You had a lot of young folks out there with basically nothing to do, no way of earning
no
a living.
Guidance.
So I wanted to ask you, how did you experience that community?
Well, I can remember when the Black Panthers and us marched in South Central.
Really?
Uh-huh. I was there at the Watts riots. I remember them. I talk about the Watts riot in my book.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed in Watts at the time. I watched buildings burn. I watched the fire department put buildings out.
How'd you feel about all that, the time the Panthers and us and all that was happening?
I was so young, I really didn't understand, but I did want to be a Panther.
You wanted to be a Black Panther?
I wanted to be a Black Panther. My brother marched with us.
Uh-huh.
He was an us. I can remember the day that he came in with a chipped tooth and his nose was bleeding. The police had hit him in the face at Will Rogers Park with a billy club.
Mm.
And I can remember the resent that I had for the police from that time on. Mm-hmm. Because my brother had become my hero. He was probably my first hero that I looked up to.
And an activist.
And he was an activist. So, and he would take me down when us did their little marching, and they have the green army jackets, and they would be marching down Broadway.
The red, black, and green. Hail the red, the black, and the green.
Yeah, so I did want to be a part of that, you know. And with any kid, and that's the way it goes, you know. And then I can remember when the Crip started, and I can remember that I wanted to be a Crip. So it's so much that our young people want to be a part of something.
And Coach, do you recall what the community was like at the time? Well, do you remember some of this stuff Rick is talking about?
The part that I do remember is that, because I'm a few years behind Rick, is that I was born in 1964. It actually happened in 65. And I stayed exactly two houses.
The Watts riots happened in 65,
I stayed exactly two houses away from where it all started on Avalon and 116th.
Mm.
So I know that all of our families were involved, because we were all had migrated into South Central. As a child, you really just don't know when you live in what we consider an urban war zone.
Yeah.
You know, until it's almost too late and you are part of the war zone. And that's where I think we developed. We developed skills, street skills, because it was accessible.
Survival skills.
Yeah, you had to survive in order to go.
That's amazing.
You know, you had to cross barriers that most people couldn't even cross. But as a child, you still just don't know that you're in that war. And I think that's what we're facing now, because of the – I don't believe we have a gang problem. We have a substance problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we were, and they had to find somebody like us who was not academically sound, had a poverty situation where you wanted to make some money in order to survive, And they found the right people. They found the right guy. You know, Rick got in there and had a tenacity for what? Trying not to be poor, didn't realize that what we were doing was going to make us even worse.
So I want to go to a clip. The Congressional Black Caucus held a hearing, you know, when it all came out about the CIA connection with crack cocaine in South LA. And I want to talk to you all a little bit about that. But just finally finishing up the early days and family stuff, you know, Tupac has a song where he sings about his mother. Actually, I love that song. I was a single mom myself for quite a long time. And also, in talking with some of the young people, the so-named gang members who told me, Margaret, we're street warriors, right? And a number of them said, you know, we watch our mothers struggle. And we're going to go out there and we're going to take care of our mothers. You know, you saw the safety net dismantled under Clinton, welfare reform was cut. When that happened, the number of women, single mothers arrested for prostitution increased because the mothers were going to find a way to feed their children.
Yes.
And a lot of folks don't recognize that reality, you know, in certain communities. And I just wondered if you had any comments on that, and before we get into the substance of the whole CIA crack.
I believe that our people do the jobs that they send into China. I believe that we want those jobs, and we want the opportunity. You know, they put you in prison, and they have what they call unicorn prison, and they pay these guys 25 cents an hour to do a job that if they was on the street, they would be making $26, $27, $30 an hour to do. Mm-hmm. And these guys do these jobs faithfully and do overtime. So when they say that we're lazy and we don't want it, I disagree with that. I believe that the drug business is one of the toughest businesses to be in. You have to be totally dedicated.
And especially smart.
Smart.
Think on your feet.
Sacrifice.
Unafraid.
Unafraid. Mm-hmm. You know, willing to die, willing to go to prison. And when you see guys that are willing to sacrifice that, I mean, if they get into any other business, there's no way they can be stopped. And when I taught guys in prison, that was one of the ways that I taught them. I was like, man, you're fearless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these other guys out here don't have the tolerance for pain and hurt that you do. So if we able to take that same energy and channel it into something positive, would be just crazy.
Right. And both of y'all were athletes. You tennis and coach, clearly you football. You still look like a football player. Right, right. So, you know.
Well, you know, that's one of the ways that we
feel
that we can get out of the ghetto. I mean, most people in the ghetto want out, because being in the ghetto is like being in prison. People in the ghetto are like, there's kids in the Jordan Downs and Nicholson Gardens, the Imperial Court, who's never been to the beach.
They had to find another way to set up our community to fail, because we've always shown historically that a man with a third grade education could move in this world, but they had to confuse our people. And that dope game, that crack, it wiped us out for generations.
Well, let's get a summary, because when the story broke the previous day, December 10th, was the anniversary of the death of Gary Webb. And, you know, we're going to talk about Gary and his work. Gary Webb, of course, being the San Jose Mercury News reporter who broke the news of the CIA turning a blind eye to crack cocaine. And one of the reasons, Ricky Ross, that you were getting it so cheap, right? The price that you were getting it at. And so the whole community was in an uproar. The Congressional Caucus held a hearing, and this is what Jesse Jackson Jr., how he summed up the situation. Let's go to that clip right now.
Here are the facts. In 1974, crack cocaine makes its first documented appearance in California. The same year, the influential Meneses family in Nicaragua establishes a relationship with the Colombian drug sellers. Between 1975 and 1979, Norwin Meneses is suspected of smuggling stolen cars from California to Central America and shipping cocaine to New Orleans and the West Coast. Sandinista revolution forces, Meneses, and others, close to the U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship, and it causes them to flee into South Central Los Angeles. Rick Ross sees his first rock of crack cocaine in December of 1979. Shortly after this, Congress is warned of a looming crack epidemic. In 1980, groups of soldiers loyal to Somoza begin forming in Honduras and Guatemala and later coalesce to form the FDN, a CIA-sponsored guerrilla army known to the world as the Contras. Ross begins selling small amounts of powder cocaine in black Los Angeles. In 1981 and 1982, Ronald Reagan authorizes covert CIA support for the Contras. Meneses and former Nicaraguan government officials Danielo Blandón meet with the CIA's military chief in Honduras to discuss fundraising efforts. Blandón and other Nicaraguans establish a cocaine sales operation in Los Angeles. Ross and Blandón meet and begin rapidly dealing and escalating the amounts of cocaine in African-American communities, mostly to dealers and to street gangs. In 1983, in response to customer demands, Ross begins marketing ready-made crack and learns how to turn a kilo of powder into three or more kilos of rock by adding an anesthetic called procaine, a process known as blow-up. His drug network expands to other states. Between 1984 and 1985, Ross and Blandón are selling 100 kilos of Meneses cocaine a week in Los Angeles.
There you have it, this congressional Black Caucus hearing. That was Jesse Jackson Jr. Summing things up. Freeway Ricky Ross, what did you think of that, about that summary? It was kind of accurate or not?
Yes, they missed a few parts. He said 100 kilos a week, and that should have been 100 kilos a day.
100 kilos a day?
Yes, a day.
Yeah.
Okay. All righty. Now, were you already in the drug trade, so to speak, when you met Blandón?
Yeah, I was. I was. I was dealing with some other Nicaraguans first. I gradually worked my way up to him.
Mm-hmm. And the shift then, I mean, when I was talking with Mark Levin, I spoke with him recently, and we were talking about, somebody had said it was a kind of a democratization of the drug trade that happened. Because before, with powder cocaine, that was so expensive, right? And a lot of people, really poor folks, couldn't get access to the powder cocaine. So with crack cocaine coming in, it meant that then people, poorer people, had access to the drug.
Is that
true? Not true.
Kind of, but not really. I mean, the courts and everybody, they want to make crack this cheap drug that is easily accessible and super, super powerful. And they did that so that they could incarcerate the young black man at a higher rate.
That's right.
Powder cocaine and rock cocaine are the same. You can't get rock without powder.
Mm-hmm.
So if a kilo of powder costs you $40,000, a kilo of rock costs you $40,000. Now, what's going to happen is when you cook it, you're going to lose. So you're not going to have as much cocaine because when you cook it, it takes all the impurities out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people really like. But as far as the price dropping and getting cheaper, that's not what happened. What happened is one of the things that I did is I actively attacked the price.
What do you mean?
I actively attacked the price of cocaine. Mm-hmm. When I started buying cocaine, an ounce of cocaine was... I think the first ounce I bought cost me $3,300.
Mm-hmm.
When I quit selling, I was selling ounces for $300. So I actively wanted to bring the price down so that my friends could get involved. I knew that my friends couldn't come up with $3,300 to pay for an ounce. And I wanted my friends to have some of the money.
Mm-hmm.
So I actively went at Danilo Blandón on them to make them bring the price down. And what I would do is take lots of money and say, you know what, if you want this money, you got to come down on the price.
And, Coach, you know, when I did see the film, a screener, I attended a screener of the film, and there was a woman in the film, and she was saying how y'all wanted to take care of your friends, about how you, you know, the kind of the good life that you were getting from this money, you wanted to spread it around, so to speak, which goes back to the point, Ricky, that you were just making. And how did you experience that
well,
coach?
Well, the experience is that, you know, anytime somebody is making some money and they having some type of success, you want to see those who are poor around you have some success. So obviously, if they see you having money, they're good friends of yours, and even if they're not good friends of yours, you still want to be active help. And you know, just one thing led to another. You know, Rick is 5 years older than I was, so when he was, you know, 25 and at his peak, I was only 19 years old. I'm still mm-hmm. just getting out of high school. Mm-hmm. But when I turn around and I'm selling it or giving it to a guy that's 15, 16, and 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But it stopped there in my mind, mm-hmm. not knowing that the ones that was 15 are going to give it to somebody 13, 12, and 11. And then, you know, as I told in the story, you know, I go into a crack house that I had and see some guys in there that was 13, 14, and 15 years old selling it to somebody that was only 10 years old.
Mm.
You know, and to witness a baby at 10 years old smoking crack was, you know, it was tough for me to digest.
Beyond the pale.
Yeah, it was tough. I didn't realize, you know, and neither did Rick, realize that the very thing that we were trying to make money off was really going to destroy everything we really loved. We didn't want nobody dying, you know, but it happens. If you sell dope, people going to die. People going to go to prison. People going to rob, steal, and kill, even to get it. They'll sell their kids to get it. We've witnessed these things mm-hmm. firsthand. And so, you know, that's why I said that the dope game kills everything you love.
Right. On that note, we are going to take a short station break. And when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Freeway Ricky Ross and Cornell Coach Ward. We're discussing a brand new film that's coming up called Freeway Crack in the System. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
City of the Angels, spread your wings for me. Looking for my dream, Eastern City moved too fast, Southern ones too slow. I can't go back to my past, and I need some place to grow. City of the Angels, clear your cloudy skies for me.
Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Our guest in studio, Freeway Ricky Ross. I think that name likely is known around the world. And Cornell Coach Ward. And of course, we are discussing the crack epidemic that swept South Los Angeles and then indeed the nation. And what people didn't know at the time is that there was a CIA Reagan administration operation where money from the sale of crack cocaine was actually going to fund the right wing Contras who were opposing the left-leaning Sandinistas in Nicaragua. There were wars in Central America, in Nicaragua, as well as El Salvador going on at the time, and Congress had refused to fund the Contras because of their horrible human rights abuses record. And so operation was kind of set up on this. Now, Freeway Ricky Ross, I wanted to ask you at what point you found out about the possibility of this connection. And I know that Gary Webb was very careful to say that he never said that the CIA or the Reagan administration planned and said, you know what, we're going to go in the black community and we're going to saturate it with drugs and we're going to help to destroy that community, that it wasn't said on that conscious level. Now, I'm going to say something else. As a woman of African descent, I don't think that they would have gone into Beverly Hills and saturated it in the same damn way. So there had to be some level of consciousness at some point as to which community they were going to go in, and vulnerable community. So Ricky Ross, your thoughts on when you found out and on this point?
Well, I didn't find out until we kind of got a hint that something was going on when Gary first contacted us about
is Gary Webb
Blandon. Mm-hmm. But Gary was really careful with his story with me.
Mm-hmm.
Gary knew I had a relationship with Jesse Katz from L.A. Times, along with quite a few other news reporters, because I was already getting major news coverage just from my drug dealings.
Mm-hmm. You know,
from me being the drug dealer that I was,
because you were so good at it.
And you know, also I had the cop, the freeway task force, who had got indicted.
The Ricky Ross task force.
Yeah, remember those cops who were stealing the money and planting drugs? Well, they had also got indicted as well. You know, both of us got indicted almost at the same time.
Mm.
So Gary was really tight with his story. I mean,
when
I first talked to him on the phone, he talked about giving me information. Well, I didn't get any information until the day that his story was published was the first time that Gary started giving me information.
Wow.
But now doing trial, if people know, when we were going to trial and my lawyer was questioning the witnesses for the government, well, he kept going back and forth from the podium to Gary Webb's spot in the audience. And the judge brought it to everybody's attention, and she said, Mr. Fenster, why are you continuously consulting with the news reporter?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Alan told him, say, well, this guy seems to have information that we don't have.
And that's something.
That the government should have turned over to us in Brady.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the first time that I kind of got an inkling, because he said something. They asked him about Enrique Ramutez, I think it was, and then Blandon said something like, oh, well, one day he went on a fishing trip with George Bush Sr. And when he came back off the trip, the word was the ends justify the means.
Could you repeat that again? Who went on this fishing trip?
Enrique Ramutez
and
George Bush Sr.
Mm,
and when he came back off the trip and he met with Meneses and Blandon and the rest of the Contras, Blandon said that he said the ends justify the means.
So you found out really rather late about the CIA.
Yeah, I was totally novice to the whole situation. I didn't know what the Central Intelligence was.
Yeah.
You're talking about a guy
who
had never read a book. I couldn't read. Mm-hmm. Who hardly watched the news. I only began to watch the news once I was in jail. So I was really a novice to everything that was going on around me. I just knew what was going on right there in my little circle with my friends. And
but you must have had a way with numbers in your head. You must have had some kind of...
Well yeah, numbers.
You know, be able to be quick at that.
I was good at numbers, but mm-hmm. my main key that I found out really was the key to my success is that I wanted for my brother what I wanted for myself.
And, you know, what about you, Coach? At what point did you find out?
Well, I didn't
what the real deal was.
What the real deal was? When I received a call from Gary Webb saying, I want you to stand with us when they did the circumstances at Locke High School. And at that time, you know, a few years earlier, you know, Rick and I had discussed that I was getting out of the game, and I went back to school. I went back to college and played football, made All-American, and became a college football coach after this drug business. And since then, I was just becoming the new head football coach at Compton Community College.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hired as the youngest African-American head coach. And that's the time when Gary approached me about standing. And I was just like,
I
was like, man, you know what, Gary? I just want to focus on what my career is now. And he told me something. He said, Cornell, a man that don't stand for nothing ain't going to fall for anything, right? And shoot, a couple of years later, you know, he was dead. You know, saying that a man committed suicide, shooting himself in the head twice. And I was like, there's no way that could possibly happen. And
was your first reaction too, right?
Yeah,
I was shocked.
That was crazy.
I was working on a documentary with Kevin Booth, the Great White Hope, and me and him was recording the interview, and I took a break to do lunch. And when I came back and called him, he told me what had happened, and I was in total shock and at awe.
Mm-hmm. Did you believe at the time that it was suicide?
Well, I still don't know, you know, if it was suicide
really?
Or not.
Mm-hmm.
I read articles where doctors said that it is possible to shoot yourself in the head twice. to me, it seems kind of odd, you know, that a person would have the awareness after you shoot yourself to take the pistol and say, you know what, I didn't do it right. I'm going to go ahead and finish this off. I think that takes a lot of willpower and consciousness. So, you know, I'd like to see the autopsy and all the evidence before I can give my absolute opinion on what happened.
Well, I absolutely don't believe that he killed himself. I think that they did. Straight up, I just don't think that that's possible.
One of the things that you know, I have to say about Gary is against injustices. And I know that with the things that's happening right now with the Ferguson and the New York deaths, I know Gary would be all over these situations. And it's sad that he's no longer here, because he was a true news reporter. You know, he wasn't the kind that, like now, where you can buy him off. You know, Gary walked away from his salary. You know, he walked away from a paying job because they no longer wanted him to report the things that he felt was important. And I think that that's really important with people in general, is that we have to do what we feel is important and not just go with the money.
You kind of almost feel like when they went after Gary Webb, it was like a warning to everybody else. Well, you do this is what's going to happen to you.
Well, you know, we got lucky enough to get an interview with Jesse Katz from the LA Times.
Oh, really? What happened with that?
Well, he talks about how at the LA Times, they never went after enhancing Gary's story. They went after Gary to discredit his story, totally. And, you know, on our documentary, Jesse apologizes to Gary and to the world, which he says in the documentary is one of his lowest points in his
career.
Yeah. What I want to do now, I'm looking at the guy, we really need hours with you guys, you know, because we haven't even gotten to the tip of the iceberg. But can we go to track 6 with Robert Juarez? You talked about, you know, going to prison and the corrupt police. I'd really like to hear that clip. And I think that's important now, too, because it is connected with what's going on, you know, right now, where you have law enforcement officers shooting down a 12-year-old black child, you know, for no good reason. Michael Brown
choking the guy out, this whole
Eric Garner. Somebody said, I think, I can't remember who it was, one of the rappers said it was like watching a snuff film on television where you go choke somebody to death, right? So let's go to that clip right now.
You had no idea what you were going to come into. Everybody carried extra firepower. And I carried an AR-15 in my trunk with 330 round magazines. At the time, we were coming up with hundreds and thousands of dollars. Okay, you'd get into a location, there'd be a closet filled with money. The federal government started seizing the money. Then the way they worked it out, that money was given back to the agency that seized it. Then that agency would use the money to fight the battle on drugs, supposedly. Captain had a meeting with us and he said, you know, if you want to keep your job, you keep taking that money because the sheriff's department needs it. The focus left, get the dope off the street to get as much money as you can and bring it in. The guy said, you know what? We got $500,000 here we're going to turn into evidence. What's going to happen to it? The first time I was given money, I'm in the parking lot. Guy walks up to me, one of my partners, and he says, here, this is your share. And I look in the paper bag and there's the money. And that's when I'm thinking, okay, what the hell do I do? Do I take it and stay part of the crew? Do I say, no, I don't want this? And then I get labeled a snitch. Took the bag, stuck it under the seat. Now, once you've done that, you're dirty. There's no going back.
All righty, this is Margaret Prescott, and that host of Sojourner Truth, and that was a clip from a brand new film, Freeway, Cracking the System. It's not yet in theaters, but it will be, by award-winning filmmaker Mark Levin, and it tells the story of broken dreams, drug dealers, dirty cops, government complicity, and it's just so compelling and engaging because it's a true story.
Yeah. I mean, to hear this guy, you know, this guy chased me down.
This same guy, yeah. Corrupt sheriff,
yeah.
That's talking, he chased you down?
They were chasing me down. They planted drugs on me. I don't know if he was there the day that they beat me up. And
the dog bit you and all
let
that?
The dog bite me and beat me in the head with flesh. See all these scars in my face?
I see. I'm looking at
it. Guy put his hand. Them was police officers that did that. While I was handcuffed. So I was at the beginning of this new military police force that we have right now. I know firsthand.
They tested it out on you.
I know firsthand. I mean, I was before Rodney King. They didn't have the cameras when they did me. And if anybody look at my background, I'm a nonviolent person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't carry a gun. I didn't fight the police. You know, I'm too little.
Even Blandon said about you, I was talking to Mark, and Blandon was saying that you always did the job of bringing down the violence, you know.
Yeah, but they didn't treat me like that.
Yeah.
The cops didn't treat me like that. These were the most elite task force in the country. This guy was on one of the most elite drug task force in the country. Every other task force around
corrupt.
The country followed their lead. So now the mentality is coming from a guy who said, we were crooked. So once you take the money, you can't go back. And that's the mentality that these other cops are still, the Rampart is a fall off from them. So all these other cops and the tactics that they're using are these same tactics that was created by guys that was stealing money, that was torturing people. I've heard of people had electric wire stuck to them. I mean, if you go in and get the trial transcripts from Dick Spender, which was the name of the federal case where the cops got indicted, they talked about taking a guy had a fish aquarium with a catfish in it, and they took the catfish and put in his jacket. You know, a catfish starts to spur you. You know, with those fins, you know, once he's touched. And, you know, just all kind of ironic stuff that these guys were doing. And then when you say that the CIA was waterlogging, I mean, it's just the same.
And you're struggling now, earning a living. You've got a T-shirt business and trying to support your kids, your books, and
I do speaking
talk
engagements.
To young folks.
Yeah, I get my speaking engagements. Another thing that everybody got to remember, too, don't think that this film is going to be marketed on mainstream TV and that you're going to hear about it everywhere you go. No, this is not going to be the case. It's going to be low budget. Very few people, Warner Brothers, Universal's not going to touch it. So if you want to hear this, you're going to have to be on the internet listening, paying attention. You may have to drive your car to a theater. I mean, and it's the same thing with my book. You know, no publisher would take my book. I have to do my book myself. And that's why it's not all over the place and nobody, but, you know, people are loving it and I'm excited about it and hopefully everybody check it out.
And Coach, you really have to wonder why that is the case, because clearly you all know what you did. Mm-hmm. You went to prison, right? You, quote-unquote, learned your lesson. Now you're out trying to really be an example and a role model for young people. So why shouldn't that be a story that they would want to promote?
But why? And the thing that I notice is that they want to pick our stories for us. They want to pick the guys. You know, they'll allow a guy like the guy who took my name, Rick Ross. They'll allow
him. The rapper, gangster rapper, making a whole lot of money off of your name.
They allow him to go to schools and talk about himself selling drugs and how wonderful the drug business is. But then they won't allow me to come in and say, that if you sell drugs, you're going to go to prison. And you could get killed. So it's kind of like a double standard, you know. I made a comment a couple weeks ago is that that I believe they're using hip-hop to send our kids to prison.
Right.
Almost like they did with cocaine.
I talked with Mark Levin a little bit, you know, about that and the whole rise of gangster rap. Here, and Michelle Alexander is in the film talking about more black men in prison today than were enslaved in the 1850s or something like that. Yeah. So it really gets to your point about the message that is selected and the messengers that are selected and the ones who are not. I want to just go to a clip now, because Freeway Ricky Ross, you do a lot of speaking to young folks.
I do.
And y'all got street cred. Been there, done that. You know, and young folks listening to what you're saying. And this is a talk you gave at Crenshaw High School that I found really quite moving. Let's go to that clip right now.
I believe that no matter what obstacles they put in front of me, I'm not going to let them stop me. I'm gonna keep going. You knock me down, I'm gonna get up. I ain't gonna lay on the floor. If you kick me, I'm gonna roll over and then get up. See, a lot of times with a lot of people, if they get hit, they lay down and they stop. They don't get up. But you gotta get up, you can't stay there. Anything that's worth having is hard. Don't believe when people tell you that it's supposed to be easy. See, because the easiest dope deal I ever did, guess what happened to it? Can anybody guess what the easiest dope deal got me?
In jail.
In jail. The easiest dope deal I ever did, send me to prison. Because my partner, he called me, I ain't selling dope no more.
Well, I thought that would be really a fitting way to wrap up this interview, but I did want Freeway Ricky Ross as well as Cornell Coach Ward for you to give some final thoughts to our listeners. And Cornell, why don't we start with you?
Well, you know, like Rick said earlier, you know, this cop business was really tough for us, not knowing the outcomes. All of these children that have been following us for so many years with this drug business, and now realize after the fact that there's just no way out, but there is a way out, and the truth truly hurts. Just sitting here going through this, because every time I hear it, no one can really feel the inside of my body how it craves in regards to all the death that it's caused. It didn't cause a good life. You know, I was in this family, the Rick Ross family, me myself. If I only did 10% of what Rick did, which is he did 2 to 3 million a day. If I did 100,000 a day, that's three million a month, 36 million a year. I've made somebody else money. We don't have a dime of that. All we have is death from that. So it's not worth it. So anytime I have an opportunity, and I've had a lot of opportunity to speak around the country and to a lot of the kids that I've coached, you know, I graduated over 6,000 student athletes all around the country. I have a lot of them that got BA degrees. I got 7 of them that got PhDs. Mm-hmm. I got several of them that are still in the NFL. And we know, they know the story, because I know if I tell them what I've been through, because I was a student athlete, I wouldn't want them to go through it. And we've seen so many countless deaths thereafter. And now we're in a situation now where there's still a problem. Why? Because it's been 25 to 30 years since this man and I have touched any drugs, and yet and still there's more drugs sold now than it was back then. So we know that they just found many more Rick Rosses. And that's a terrible thing that our country has turned a blind eye to. You can tell me how you can fly to the moon, but you can't tell me how all this dope coming in here? That's an issue that we need to solve, you know, in policy, in Sacramento, in government, in Washington, everywhere. But it's not talked about, because why? It's big business. It's a $1 trillion industry, and they're about making their money. They still building prisons, but we can't find no jobs.
Yeah, and, you know, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, in the hearing, she said that in going around the country, Ricky Ross talking to young people, you know, the brothers were saying, we don't have no planes to be bringing in these drugs. You know, so, like, on that kind of level, the young men, particularly young black men, young brown men that are being incarcerated behind this, they're not really the ones in charge of this trade. But I wanted to get some final thoughts from you, Ricky Ross, because that message of if you're down, get on up. Yeah, get on up is so important.
You know, a lot of people when they're hit, you know, they have a tendency to quit. You know, when I was in prison, I was in prison with a lot of guys with life sentences for selling drugs, just like me. And so many of them had given up and quit. But I refused to give up. I refused to let prison be my coffin. And I kept fighting, you know. And
refused to be broken.
Absolutely. And one of the things I want to say to corporate America is that we will do the jobs that you send into China. We will do the jobs that you send into India. We will do those jobs that you send into all these other countries. So leave these jobs here. Let us Americans work, because we're spending our money with you.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank Daniel Voll for his help with today's show and the entire Sojourner Truth team. I would love to hear from you. You could email me directly at mpkpfk@gmail.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Join KABU and Kofallin Cultural Center on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral historians before the screening of Keita, Heritage of the Griots, a film which blends modern events with magical realism, mythology, and history. Again, that's an evening of the culture of Mali, including the screening of the film Keita, Heritage of the Griots, on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.